I wasn't aware of that.
I think they've changed that requirement. But the old days, your typewritten thesis was not the fulfillment of the requirements for the doctorate. That was sufficient to have the final oral exam. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a thesis committee, a standard committee, and so on, but that still wasn't...
It's standard thesis committee. I had a thesis committee of five or six people that went on for about 3 hours. And because my thesis was in the zoology department on a plant subject, the professor of plant physiology was also on the committee, and one of the other people from zoology, geneticist, was on the committee. And Hans Clark, who was chairman of biochemistry at the medical school, was on the committee. And one of the people from the chemistry department who taught the photochemistry was on the committee. I had taken this course, of course. So that I knew everybody on the committee beforehand, but nevertheless, they gave me a rough time.
Could you tell me something about Simon Schlaer, who you collaborated with during that time period?
Well, Simon Schlaer was Heck's personal research assistant as well as graduate student. And Simon Schlaer had a great gift for equipment. He could build anything. He could design anything. When it came to the intellectual side of science, he was frightened by it. This is psychological, I suppose, more than anything else. After Simon Schlaer went off to Los Alamos sometime at the end of the war, and he was there, I think, about a year or 2 years before Hank died, and stayed there the rest of his life, as far as I know, designing all kinds of special equipment, mostly photographic equipment. Or whatever went on at Los Alamos in that period.
So when you were starting to repeat Warburg's experiments, you comment you had to start from scratch, virtually put everything together. Did he assist you then?
He helped me a great deal. I had to do the work. You didn't get away with anything. This was part of physiology at the time and part of science. You learned how to build your own equipment. And part of building your own equipment is that I took Warburg's measurements and went to the glass blower and had to convince him how to do this and how to put a scale on the thing and building the constant temperature bath to regulate the temperature and designing the light source. I did all of that. It took months. But in the same way, when the published work came along of glass electrodes, I ordered the glass from England, had to blow my own glass electrodes and assemble the glass electrode using a type K potentiometer and Wheatstone bridge and all the rest of it, the Lindemann electrometer, put all this together. You couldn't buy any of this stuff commercially. The first commercial glass electrode equipment in this country was, I think, available only around 1939 or 1940. And that's how Beckman got his start, with his simplified. The first commercial glass electrode assembly in this country, which I remember seeing and using afterwards, was made by the Cambridge Instrument Company, which was British, in a new factory in New York State, up in New York State. And that's what we had, for example, at the Rockefeller Institute. Beckman's pH meter came along around, what, 1930?
Late 30s, 38.
Late 38, 39. But I had a glass electrode assembly that I was working with to measure the pHs of my buffers back in 1935-36. You couldn't use a hydrogen electrode with carbonate bicarbonate buffers, which I needed to do photosynthesis. Because if you put in enough hydrogen, you expelled all the CO2 and you no longer had a buffer. Bringing back memories. Can you stop for just
certainly.
A second? I think I'm going to go visit the...
That work that you did, which showed the difference from Warburg's original experiments, you commented about I really didn't want to tell Hecht what you had found. And yet he reacted differently, I guess, than you had expected. Talk a little bit about that experience and how was that accepted? I think you've commented, really, people have ignored that for the most part for a while. Is that true?
Well, I think, let me go back to Hecht first. I think part of the student's psychology is that you don't like to contradict the great authority. And after all, Warburg's stuff was widely accepted. He had pioneered in a great many of these things. And later on, of course, his later work, which was already, he was long out of photosynthesis, of course, because the photosynthesis work had been done in the early 20s. And we're now talking about basically around 1934-35. When Warburg's work had taken a completely different turn. He was now isolating enzymes and very important coenzymes and all that kind of thing. And probably one of the greatest experimental laboratories in the history of biochemistry. And you suddenly find that you can't repeat exactly what he's doing. Is there an artifact? Because what is the difference between the curve involving a first order process with light and dark phases versus something with second order? It all depends on the slope of a small part of the curve. The asymptote in this direction is the same, the slope down here is the same. It could be an artifact due to error, so you calibrate everything all over again and check it all out, and you repeat sufficiently to make sure that you're right. And at that point, I showed it to him. And I think he had been becoming a little bit impatient as to why I hadn't set this thing up for the students any earlier. But finally, I told him about it, and he said, that's great. And he looked at it. He looked over all the data, and I showed him all the repetitions and all the rechecking of the calibration of the filters and the calibration of the light source in absolute units and all the rest of it. He was just absolutely delighted with it. So that the fact that it made very little impression, I think, was due to two things. The field was completely at a standstill. The physical side of studying photosynthesis was fine, and the pioneer work had all been done. You knew the chlorophyll was the light-absorbing source. You knew that it used carbon dioxide and water, and it made some kind of carbohydrate precursor, or whatever you want to call it. People always wrote CH2O in parentheses, question mark, that kind of thing. But there was no way of getting at any kind of mechanism at that time. If you disrupted the plant cell and put these things, say, some kind of a buffer solution trying to resemble what was inside a plant cell, nothing happened, basically. And it was not until really 1938 that Robin Hill in England, now deceased, just died this past year, showed that if you took chloroplasts out of a green leaf and suspended them in the right kind of buffer and shined light on them, that you got reducing power and that it would reduce ferric compounds to ferrous compounds, or that it would reduce other kinds of things. And this was called the Hill reaction for many, many years. It was the first breakthrough in attempting to study any kind of mechanism. But this was a couple of years after my studies on the light thing, and I suppose the attitude was, and perhaps quite rightly, so what? If it isn't a first order process, he doesn't tell us what it is. All he says is this is not a first order process. And the conclusion of my paper that is more complicated than a simple first order process, it leaves people cold. And in that sense, I suppose, kinetics of any biological phenomenon leaves one cold unless you can get more at mechanism. But the old joke was you did kinetics when you didn't know what else to do. There was no way of getting at mechanism at that time. We understood nothing about, or practically nothing about, oxidation-reduction reactions in general, whether it be purely chemical reactions or the biological oxidation-reduction reactions, or here the most complicated reduction reaction there is. We knew that we didn't really know anything, but we didn't really know how complicated it was going to turn out to be. I did know, however, that I was finished with that kind of kinetic study when I was getting ready to leave the lab, and I was anxious to leave the lab. I could have stayed on as an instructor at least for a few more years. There was no likelihood that I was going to get tenure because the department. Rotation for somebody who had gotten his doctor's degree and needed a few years to get himself established. And I suppose the inspiration for going abroad was the fact that European biochemistry was developing in an entirely different direction. They were isolating enzymes. They were studying intermediary metabolism. They're not like the medical schools here. The zoology department at Columbia had invited John Northrop to come and give the Jessup lectures. And it was Northrop's presentation of crystalline pepsin and its behavior and trypsin and chymotrypsin. Here was enzymology, protein chemistry. This was what was exciting. You now had something that you could get hold of as a pure material and get to study. And I realized that what I wanted to get into was enzymology. Intermediary metabolism as such didn't interest me in terms of the steps of the individual reactions, but what was the mechanism of catalysis? What kind of enzymes were there? Were they all simple proteins? What kind of things? And it was also at that time that Warburg was beginning to publish his work on oxidation reduction enzymes, on dehydrogenases. Stuff was coming, had been coming out of Meyerhoff's laboratory also in Germany until he had to leave. So there was no possibility that I was going to go to Germany to work. I didn't want to go to work in Northrop's laboratory because Northrop was almost stone deaf and was very difficult to communicate with him. And the interests of the laboratory were rather narrow, and for my sense. And Cambridge was very exciting and very attractive. This is where modern biochemistry was flourishing in all its aspects. And I talked to Hecht about it, and he says, wonderful, put in your applications for fellowships. And I thought, supplying to the National Research Council for an NRC fellowship, and Hecht said, well, he says, you know, maybe I've worn out my welcome with the NRC because everybody else who came through this lab has gone to the NRC for a fellowship and gotten it. Maybe you ought to apply to Guggenheim. I said, all right, not any better. So I applied to the Guggenheim and was lucky enough to get a fellowship.
You had already started some work at 36-38 period in Columbia with chlorophyll, so being associated with a protein.
That was that in my last year after my thesis and after my degree. I had done some more kinetic work to finish up some things that were not in my thesis. But I had been reading a lot of the literature, wondering where an opening might be to get into some kind of mechanism. And as I said in my little essay, it was in the air. this was the period in the 30s when it was recognized that Sumner's urease was not an artifact, that Northrop and Cunitz's enzymes were not artifacts, these were all proteins. And George Wald, who had come from Hecht's lab and gone to Europe, had shown that rhodopsin was a conjugated protein with a vitamin A derivative written out as the prosthetic group of a small protein. It was also the period that Michael Heidelberger and his cohorts had demonstrated that antibodies were protein. So here we had, and the first of the hormones were coming along as proteins, not only insulin, which had been a little earlier, but the pituitary hormones. Lactogenic hormone that had been isolated in fairly pure form at that time, and so on. So here were enzymes, hormones, antibodies, a visual protein. What's the situation with chlorophyll? And reading literature, was quite clear that the absorption spectrum of chlorophyll A, which is three times as much as chlorophyll B in the green leaf, has a maximum absorption around 660. Depends on the wavelength. In the red, there's this blue absorption as well. Everybody would measure the absorption spectrum of a green leaf in a higher plant. Absorption maximum was around 677, 678. And making me remember numbers from 50 years ago, which I do. This was too big a discrepancy to explain very simple things, and a few people had suggested it might be protein. But nobody had really done anything about it, because this was all insoluble material. Unless you took a strong organic solvent, like alcohol, and disrupted it, you couldn't extract the chlorophyll. Well, reading over that literature, I realized that this was very similar in some respects to what George Wald was describing for rhodopsin. That if you took a simple organic solvent in which chlorophyll was freely soluble, like ether or PET ether, you couldn't extract any chlorophyll from the green leaf, no matter how much you ground it. But if you added alcohol to disrupt the structure, then it would go freely into ether or PET ether. This sounded to me like denaturing the protein. Then the question was how to solubilize it. As I've said, I introduced the use of detergents into this whole picture, because the use of detergents for extracting insoluble proteins had been invented by Willy Kuhne in Heidelberg in 1878, but had never been applied to anything else but rhodopsin from 1878 to 1937. Nobody thought that this is the way to extract proteins. After all, there were plenty of water-soluble proteins. Why worry about those things that were insoluble? And I went to Europe with the idea of not just studying the chlorophyll protein complex, but inducing Kaelin to let me solubilize cytochrome oxidase the same way. Only he said, what you're working on is more exciting, leave the oxidase to me. So I got the credit for an anonymous credited to an E. Smith in a footnote.
I remember seeing that. Yes.
Which I think is... didn't matter.
You mentioned that, I think it was in that...
And of course now, in the last couple of years, Mr. Huber and his cohorts have gotten a Nobel Prize for studying the chlorophyll protein. The structure of the chlorophyll protein complex by X-ray diffraction, and have mapped out the entire complete structure of the bacterial chlorophyll protein complex using simply a different detergent than the one I used. So there's something in having the intellectual satisfaction of having been right, but 40 years premature or 30 years premature or what have you.
Well, that's not an unusual case in history of science, where you have an idea that can't be followed up because the technique is...
The time wasn't right. There was no way of following. X-ray diffraction didn't exist. When I was in Cambridge, in Kaelin's laboratory, and I worked in the big lab with Kaelin and his personal research assistant, Ted Hawtrey, who later married one of my graduate students, and Max Perutz. Max Perutz would come in and crystallize chlorophyll, and he was studying it, trying to see what he could do with this thing. He started working on the crystallization and the structure of chlorophyll in 1930s, before I came there, 37, 38. Mm-hmm. And he was working on it that entire time. And that structure was not solved until basically the myoglobin hemoglobin structures in 1957, because, well, a little before that, because the first structure of myoglobin was presented at a symposium in Paris, which I was also at, by John Kendrew in 1957. And hemoglobin was almost immediately after. So there we are. But it took not only the improvements in the X-ray diffraction technique, the invention of a good diffractometer where you could measure intensity of spots, and high-speed computers, so you can calculate all these things. You had to do it by hand, they'd still be at it. They'd still be at it.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you, too, is when you measured absorption spectrum, still back at Columbia, this is pre-Beckman DU days, what did you refer
Schlaer
to?
Schlaer had built a magnificent, very sensitive spectrophotometer in the visual, which did not involve the use of the eye, unlike all the matching spectrophotometers which I had used in England, for example. Schlaer had built a very precise spectrophotometer for studying rhodopsin and other visual pigments. And it was based on simply not two nickel prisms, but on a three nickel prism arrangement, where in effect it was sensitive out to about 5/10,000ths of an absorption unit. And the spectra that I measured, even though I did some of it in England, I did them all over again with Schlaer spectrophotometer, and an exceedingly precise instrument. Didn't even bother to put the points on. Nobody's ever measured anything as more accurately than that.
Which paper is that?
This is the 1941 paper, Journal of General Physiology. And I measured the conversion of the chlorophyll to the theophyton by strong detergents like sodium dodecyl sulfate. And look at these kinetic curves. Mm. Louis Hammett would have been proud of that. Affect the pH on rate.
Yes.
But
that spectrophotometer wasn't automatic recording, though.
It was not automatic recording. It was very tedious. If you measured at one wavelength, you could get readings every few seconds in effect, but if you wanted to do a complete spectrum, this took an hour, at least an hour to go through, depending on how many points you wanted. But was what's-his-name's automatic spectrophotometer that came along very quickly after that.
The Hardy? That was the first, I think it was the one that GE made in the late 30s.
The one that GE made was based on the one that had been designed at MIT.
Harrison?
By a man who later became the president of Caltech. What's the matter with me? Lee DuBridge.
Oh, okay.
Lee DuBridge had designed the first automatic spectrophotometer while he was still at MIT, and it was his model that GE took and built into a commercial machine. I can't think of it, because Lee DuBridge is a very close friend, actually, whom I met after I came to Los Angeles. And we used to see each other regularly, but he's not well now.
You also, I'm still looking at that pre-Cambridge period started at your some association with pickles at Rockefeller and sedimentation stuff. I think you did some.
I did more of that actually after I came back from Cambridge.
But you did start something before you left with him.
I did some preliminary work in the ultracentrifuge because he had designed the new ultracentrifuge. Remember, the Spedberg instrument was an oil turbine machine which was first developed around 1924-25. It cost a fortune to build and took a full-time engineer to operate. And there were only two in the United States. One at Wisconsin, which the Rockefeller Foundation built for Jack Williams, and the other one was at DuPont, which they had built for their high polymer studies. The Rockefeller people had wanted an ultracentrifuge for virus work. And the man who was involved in the yellow fever program had hired Ed Pickles away from Virginia to come and design a practical ultracentrifuge of low cost. And Ed Pickles designed the air-driven ultracentrifuge at the Rockefeller Foundation, which was housed at the Rockefeller Institute. But Ed was not a member of the Rockefeller Institute staff. He was paid through the foundation because this was all their virus work. And but he was free to collaborate, and Hecht had collaborated with him on some work on rhodopsin, and I had gotten to know him through that. And then after I came back from England, when I knew more about this chlorophyll protein thing, I collaborated with him by going downtown from Columbia. Because after I came back, after the war started, I spent the first 4 months in New York to finish up and to do this work with Pickles.
Okay. Well, we can talk a bit more about him when we get to that point.
Well, you know his history.
I know a little bit about it, yes.
Well, he went out subsequently to start Spinco, right. Specialized, which Beckman took over.
Yes. You left in July of 38 then for Cambridge.
Left in July 38 to tour France and to go to the International Congress of Physiology in Zurich in August 1938, because Kalin had said there's no point in coming in late July or August, nobody will be there. So we went to the Congress first and then came back to Cambridge.
You've commented again in your essay about the fact that you'd never had a formal course in biochemistry. You realized when you got there how little you really knew. Curious about that, given everything you had been doing up to that point, but I guess you felt you were, in retrospect, that you were a little naive in what you were doing. Yeah, but maybe not for that time period.
Well, I was very naive in many ways. Let me put it this way. The kind of biophysical chemistry that I knew from Selig Hecht and from Columbia, I knew very well. But it was very highly specialized. I knew a good deal about protein physical chemistry. I knew a good deal about photochemistry and absorption phenomenon, and about the chemistry of absorption in terms of the kinds of compounds that show color behavior and all this kind of thing. On the other hand, I knew practically nothing about carbohydrate metabolism, or very little about the structure of carbohydrates in general. I knew little or nothing about lipids and lipid metabolism. I know very little about general field of amino acid metabolism. Not that the knowledge was all that deep at that stage, but there was still a great deal of knowledge. And I had had no exposure to this whatsoever. So that my knowledge was good of certain specialized areas of what today would call some aspects of bioorganic chemistry or biophysical chemistry, but other aspects of biochemistry, for example, I knew absolutely nothing about. For example, I came to Cambridge and I discovered that B people like Bill Peary and others have done very detailed work on the metabolism of sulfur amino acids. I had known nothing about that work. A emigre from Germany named Ernst Friedman, who was working in Hopkins Laboratory, had done a tremendous amount of work on the metabolism of aromatic amino acids. I know nothing about that kind of work. So that there was an area of what we would today call very classical biochemistry that I know absolutely nothing about. I'd never been exposed to it, because if I had taken a standard course in biochemistry at a medical school, I would have known something about these things. But because I had never taken that course, and I didn't know anything about them, but I sat in on the lectures in Cambridge, so I got the equivalent of taking the course, only I did most of it at the advanced level right away, rather than the beginning level.
Can you tell me a little bit about what Conlon's group was like at Cambridge, and what the Institute was like?
This is one of the great